Good afternoon and welcome to Introduction to Chiron. Thank you for being here on Easter Sunday. For those of you who are in the class, we've had quite a few registrations. Have a small, intimate group today, though I see a few names that I recognize. This class is going to basically be an overview of Chiron, and then in the second part, what most people would consider an advanced kind of a process, which is how to work with somebody on their Chiron transits. And I think, though, that the Chiron transit process of basically sitting and listening to someone tell you about what they experience in their astrology is an elementary and essential point of beginning that makes it possible to do astrology with people when you may have only limited knowledge of astrology, but you feel comfortable working with people and holding a presence for them, and you do the thing that all good practitioners encourage people to do, which is to let them do most of the work. So that's the idea. And let's jump in. And by the way, I'm going to follow the outline that I sent out this morning. That's on the resources page. And then I'll just pause at the in between sections, and you can raise your hand if you want to make a comment or ask a question, which I would encourage you to do. And if you want to do that, just press star 2 on whatever device you're on. I'm not sure how it works if you're on a web call of some kind, but star 2, you raise your hand, you'll jump to the top of my queue, and then I'll call on you the moment that I take a breath. So Chiron was discovered in 1977, and when that happened, there hadn't been anything new in astrology since 1930 when Pluto was discovered. So that's quite a long gap. That's 47 years. And what was so interesting is that no book came out written in English. There was a book in German, which is a pretty good book. I don't have the title handy, but it pretty good book, had come out on Pluto until the 80s when Jeffrey Wolf Green published Pluto Evolutionary Journey of the Soul. And right around that time, I think a year or two later, the first book on Chiron, well, the first books on Chiron in 82, 83, started coming out. Ermine Lantero and Zane Stein, and then Barbara Hand Clow, Melanie Reinhardt all came out with books in the, I guess, the early 1980s. I don't have a chronology, but I'm gathering around 83 or so is when they started coming out. And prior to that, there was quite a bit of excitement about Chiron because something new had actually happened. And the late 70s were an exciting time in American history. The country was finally freed of Nixon and the Vietnam War. And there was this exuberant moment in the late 70s where there was a sense of potential and a sense of freedom. And I mean, imagine if all the major horror shows in the news that we're dealing with every day just one day had some closure and were resolved. So all of a sudden, in the mid-70s, around 73, 74, the war ends and Nixon is gone. And what followed was a moment of openness that is quite rare to find. And a lot of things were happening. And one of them was a nascent holistic movement. And it was right into the middle of this that a planet was spotted in Taurus by an astronomer named Charles Kowal, and was named for the mythical first centaur of Greek mythology, whose whole thing was basically education and medicine. So he's a teacher of medicine, teacher of warfare, to people like Jason and Achilles and those cats. And battlefield medicine and generally medicine as a total subject, which he had been taught by Apollo. So he was a surgeon and teacher. And Kowal gave this planet its name because it was in such an unusual orbit and such an unusual planet. There had been no planet found in anything like a 50-year orbit. There's really nothing in a 50-year orbit that I know of, not with a name anyway. And additionally, it had properties of a planet, an asteroid, and a comet. Technically, it is a very large proto-comet, like a massive comet nucleus. Most comet nuclei are quite small, 4, 5, 10 kilometers. Even the big bright ones that come close to the Earth, they melt, and a lot of what you see is the sun refracting in the particles that are melting off of the comet when it comes close to the sun at perihelion. And so Chiron, at 160 to 180 kilometers for a chunk of ice, is a large comet. Jane Liu, the co-discoverer of the Kuiper Belt, told me she is certain that it was pulled in from the Kuiper Belt. It is not in a particularly stable orbit. I think its orbit is only accurate to something around the year 1000. There's a comment somewhere up on Astrodienst by Dieter Cook about when to stop believing the Chiron ephemeris, because it's only recently been put in this 50.7 year orbit. And so you can only trace it back so far. And that's very unusual to have something in an orbit that's been so recent. It's probable that something like Saturn has been in its orbit for, a billion years or something like that. It's just very stable. And these little planetary bodies like Chiron can get pulled out of the Kuiper Belt, this kind of cloud of comets and things out in Pluto's region, when there's a big alignment. So if imagine like Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune all lined up and created a gravitational anomaly, things would be guided or pulled in. Imagine them spiraling in. And so at some point, past 1,500 years or so, Chiron got pulled in, and it's in this orbit for a relatively brief time, but we've got it now. And Kowal, Charles Kowal, who's very prolific discoverer of planets, and then for the end of his career, his job was to be the guy who got the emails from the Hubble Space Telescope and basically downloaded the photos from the Hubble Telescope every morning when he came to work. Among many other discoveries, discovered Chiron and named it because Chiron is a hybrid of a human and a horse, and really was a weird planet. It was a hybrid of all these other things, and so he gave it that name. And very quickly, astrologers noted that there was something significant. There was an article in the New York Times, I think in early 78, that somewhat inaccurately described it as a new planet, even though it's kind of a planetoid. And astrologers noticed, guys like Al Morrison and Zane Stein and a few others kind of led the way and began a publication called The Key. I think Morrison was the publisher of that. I'm not sure about that. And there was research done, and it was a forward-thinking, exciting time in astrology. And at that time, there was the first recent break from tradition of the only available medicine being the doctor and the only available therapy being the psychiatrist. And we started to see the proliferation of things like naturopathy, acupuncture, and chiropractic. And so one of the things that this did was it converted astrology gradually, and not entirely, and there was a setback, from being a kind of a occult thing, kind of either a spooky occult thing you know, written about on the pages of H.P. Blavatsky and Alice Bailey and other, you know, spooky things back in the, back in the day, to coming out front and being more oriented on healing. So astrology starts off in ancient Greece around, as we know it, starts off in ancient Greece around 2,400 years ago, and it's included as part of things like trigonometry and philosophy and music theory. Astrological chart looks a lot like a circle of fifths. And then over the years, it is developed and then finally swallowed by the occult. The church gets hold of it, makes a bunch of rules. Rob Hand wrote his doctoral dissertation on military astrology in medieval times. And then there's a series of revivals over the last three or so hundred years, starting in 1647 with a book by William Lilly. And finally, in the 20th century, there's a big emergence. But astrology is still a little bit spooky. It's a bit occultish. And then in the 60s and early 70s, it comes out as a kind of a pop art, basically, with star scrolls in the supermarket. Anybody remember those? And newspaper horoscopes being popular, and then Chiron gives it a kind of a serious tone and a serious cast. And there's research done about a new planet. I mean, this is very exciting, and it didn't last for long. Books start coming out in the early 1980s, and then in 92, there's another centaur discovered, and that's not really noticed by very many people. 93, the third centaur, 94, 95, a few more centaurs are discovered, and then not so long after, they're named. But by this time, astrology is not paying so much attention, because Project Hindsight starts in 1993 or so, and it, instead of looking toward the future, it does something that was very important, which is recover ancient texts. But I don't think Project Hindsight ever saw itself as something that was going to, you know, take over all progress in astrology. I think it just positioned itself as something that was dedicated to making sure that the past was filled in and accurate, that there were correct translations of things, and that there were abundant resources from ancient times. But what happened is ancient astrology, classical astrology, and to some extent medieval astrology become a kind of a cult. And so, as I remember it, as late as 2002, 2003, there's a lot of excitement about the discovery of minor planets and Kuiper objects. The first Kuiper object is discovered by Jane Liu and David Jewett in 1992. And then telescopes are pointed at the Kuiper belt, and there's lots of discoveries, and astrology got excited about Varuna in 2000 and Quasar in 2002, and then Sedna like in 2003 or so. And then it all seems to just stop for some reason. The new millennium comes, 9/11 comes, and to me, it seems like most astrology becomes a kind of a retro movement, and a lot of the old values of things like prediction and things like judging a nativity, judging a horoscope and all that start to come back in to vogue. And then a lot of kids are using charts that only have seven planets. They start leaving out Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and Chiron, and all of that excitement about the centaurs and the Kuiper objects seems to evaporate, except among, you know, a very small group of people. I could maybe name, you know, 5 or 10 people I know who are into it, and people go back to saying things like the jury is still out on Chiron. And the minor planet movement gets a kind of a momentary revival in, I believe, 06, when when Eris becomes a thing, you know, when Eris becomes a point of focus, and there's the International Astronomical Union conference in Prague in the summer of 2006, and Pluto gets demoted, it gets a minor planet number, Eris gets a minor planet number and is deemed a dwarf planet along with Pluto, and then Ceres is now recategorized yet again and categorized as a dwarf planet. So where we stand today is that a lot of the early progress on astrology as under Chiron's influence as a healing art and kind of legitimate area of study, to me, seems to have been supplanted by this more fate-based stuff coming out of the kind of derivatives of Project Hindsight. And I knew two of the guys who founded Project Hindsight really well, Bob Schmidt, who died recently, Rob Hand, still alive and kicking, and then Rob Zoller. And I don't think any of them had this intention. But what happened was we end up looking backwards and not forward. So Chiron is still forward-looking, and it is still as helpful and useful as a tool as ever. And in another class, we can go into the other Centaur discoveries and how they work together, how to use them. We'll get a little taste of that in the sample chart that we're using. But to work with Chiron, we set aside all the ethics of ancient astrology in terms of its rendering a judgment. People would go to astrology to get a judgment. Will I inherit money from my wife's father? Yes or no? Will I succeed? Will my child succeed? It was in a way very cut and dried. And according to Jeff Cornelius, in the marketplace of ideas, which seems to be in the marketplace of spices and food, you could either go to the astrologer and cast horary, or you could get a chicken entrail reading, and they just cut a chicken open and read its guts. And that was, in 1650, that's what was going on. And so now we have an opportunity to use what we've learned what were some quite brilliant therapy movements in the 1960s and 1970s, which incidentally also suffered a setback, only this setback came from progress, not from a retro movement. And the progress, or supposed progress, was drugs that in many ways, this started with the development of lithium, I think in the 50s, but by the 80s, most people wanting to feel better were not so interested in doing therapy or process work. They were going to take some form of a mood stabilizer or mood enhancer. And so I think this also has had an impact. So when we talk about working with Chiron, in my view, we're really talking about a method of astrology that borrows from the best teachings of therapy and the best teachings of spirituality. And then as I practice and teach and suggest, and as some of my colleagues do, like Melanie Reinhart, you engage the client in a bit of a journey, and you let them keep possession of their reality. So there's a lot of people still to this day who expect the astrologer to just tell them something. Tell me about my life. Tell me who I am, basically, is what the question is. And Chiron reverses that, where the astrologer's role is to find out. And it can be challenging, partly depending on who you are, partly depending on who your clients are, and depending on your skill at turning things around in the conversation. We have to work with a kind of an impulse for people to think astrology is about telling them who they are. And there's a lot of astrologers who promulgate this myth and pretend to have a power that I think that they don't have, and who pretend to do something that I don't think is particularly ethical. And you can see this all over the place, and you might start to get annoyed by it when you start to get results on real subject matter, using a more therapeutic technique like working with Chiron. And we happen to be alive at a time when a lot of people are really, really hurting. There are countless unresolved sexual injuries which we see bubbling around in the Me Too movement. And my assessment of the Me Too movement is that it is either the tip of the iceberg or grossly misguided, because most of people's material they need to work with is early childhood stuff. It has nothing to do really with what's going on so much in their adult life, but reconciling with what happened to them as children. And then the culture has continued to inflict both relational and sexual injuries on people. And so just looking at that, there's this whole morass of people who are really struggling emotionally and don't have the kinds of resources available that were, for example, available in 1977, where there was very daring stuff going on in a number of different therapy movements and books coming out. I mean, there was a time when Games People Play was a bestseller. Escape from Freedom by Eric Fromm was a bestseller. I mean, can you imagine that? And so this is just not, you know, the prevailing situation today. But the thing is, if you hang out, if you learn how to do work with people and you hang out your shingle, you will eventually be inundated by the number of people who need your help and your support. That's never an issue. So I think the key is to get good at your practice, you know, before that happens, to make sure that you know how to do no harm or do as little harm as you possibly can, and you know how to work with people with a, you know, coming to you with a wide diversity of circumstances. And one of the most important things you can offer as an astrologer, and not all astrologers offer it, but one of the most important things you can offer as an astrologer, is that you don't have a button on your desk. You're not going to judge. You're not going to look them up in the DSM. You're not going to prescribe. And further, not use astrology to do any of those things. So if you think about, you know, those metaphors coming out of like the psychiatric department, the button on the desk, the DSM diagnosis, the medication, the ward, the lock ward, the straitjacket, and all of those things, there's versions of that in astrology that can be put on people. And when you're doing astrology, you're doing a kind of psychic surgery. And you may not quite recognize it, but one comment that you say to someone can change the direction of their life. And so it's important that you know the power of your words, and that you know the way to keep your tools clean and sharp, and how to use them minimally and delicately, and let people own their material and let people own their process. Now, because of let's pause there. If there are any thoughts at this point, then I'll continue about Chiron's bad reputation. So, if you have any thoughts, share star two. Bad reputation. So, one of the things that happens under Chiron transits is that people's lives can go really wonky. And the reason for that is because Chiron has a way of shining the light in all of the difficult places and the untended injuries. And so when people's lives go a little wild under Chiron transits things happen, the intensity level goes up, and there are astrologers who are not necessarily properly prepared in how to deal with this. This all contributes to Chiron getting a bad reputation as like a bad planet, as a malefic planet. Al Morrison said one of the cleverest things about Chiron, which is that Chiron is the inconvenient benefic. It helps, but it often does so in a way that at first seems inconvenient and takes people out of their comfort zone. And we all know how much emphasis there is on comfort these days and making people comfortable, and nobody wants their buttons pushed and there's got to be a trigger warning on everything. Well, Chiron is the thing that takes you out of your comfort zone, and it's the thing that will trigger you when you need to be triggered, and it will point out where you need help and work and assistance and at the same time, always provide the resources to do that. So as the astrologer, you want to be working the whole chart and the whole person, and keep a very wide view. And then Chiron will give you the close-in microscopic view, but you want to be working your mind to have the wide view of who a person is. And one of the things you will learn in therapy and in therapy training, if you get the right training, is how to work with people as they go through their spiritual emergencies and help them emerge from their emergencies, because there's going to be spiritual emergencies under Chiron. That's just how it is. And many key life transits will come with this. And you can guide people forward mostly by your example and mostly by your, broad view, and most of all by not judging them. Now, one of the things that Chiron presents us with is situations where we practitioners need to ask for help. And so this is a spiritual matter, and some would consider it a religious matter, but it's certainly a spiritual matter of how to work with your inner teacher and how to guide people inward to work with their inner teacher. This is not the kind of thing that can be necessarily taught in a class. All of A Course in Miracles and many other paths are devoted. I think in my experience, A Course in Miracles is the one that is the most specifically focused on how to train your mind to work with your inner teacher and ask for help when you need it. So, for example, in Course in Miracles concept, you don't try to forgive someone. You ask for help forgiving someone. You learn to ask for help. And so when you're working with a client, you want to make sure that the first thing you do is you ask for help and you put the whole thing under the guidance of spirit, and that you learn to keep listening to your inner voice the whole time that you're working with the person, and then let the inner light in your mind reach into other people's minds and activate them to the awareness of their inner light. And one of the things that happens when you're working with Chiron is you tend to get situations that just seem impossible and just seem so painful. You don't know what to do with it. And one of the things you learn when you go to lifeguard training, I mean, I don't know if it's on day one or day two of like basic life saving, is how to avoid a double drowning. If you look at the statistics, there's quite a few double and triple drownings. People try to save someone, and then both people drown. And so you want to keep that idea of the double drowning in mind. And in lifeguard training, you learn to reach, throw, row, go. Right? You reach with a stick or your hand. You keep your body at the edge of the pool. You row out in a boat, so you've got something stable. Or in second part, throw. You throw a life preserver or something. And then if you have to, you go personally and get them. And in life-saving, they teach you to clock the person on the head if they're struggling, to knock them senseless for a second. You're actually allowed to clock them on the head to tow them back in using side-stroke life-saving tow, which, fortunately doesn't have to happen that often, but it does happen. And so one of the things you want to learn in therapy training is how to not have a double drowning, but also how to not suppress the person you're working with in terms of their expression of what's going on for them and what these transits are about. So, the process we're going to do with Cheryl a little bit later, I still do with every client. I do it in the form of a questionnaire. I take the Chiron dates and write them out for them. And almost every time I read these, and I wonder how it is that this person managed to get through this. And the idea is not to dwell on the past, right? The idea of working with the transits, which we'll get to in a second, in a little while, is to understand some context and to see how the person responds when the juice is turned up in their chart. Because Chiron turns up the juice like pretty much no other planet can. And the beauty of Chiron is that it does so in a way that is, in a sense, transparent. It brings out what's underneath it without distorting it. And generally, when the material is particularly rough, it can be a sign that there was some avoidance, which, again, you don't judge. You just want to take it at face value for what it is and keep listening. And then after a while, you will learn a lot about the person, and you'll be able to offer them something that you couldn't offer. Again, questions at star two. The wounded healer thing is often thrown around with Chiron, and the reason I don't like this terminology is, first of all, it's just bandied about so casually. Like, you can walk up to the gumball machine and put a quarter in it and get, like, some wounded healer chewing gum. And there's plenty of wounded healers walking around. I mean, there's plenty of people walking around that in all honesty, I'd rather talk to the neighborhood car mechanic about my problems than the majority of astrologers. This is largely, I think, because in astrology, anyway, there's a certain arrogance that follows the power that astrology seems to confer on people, and, you know, this, like, knowledge and mystical bullshit. And, this must be subverted. This needs to be consciously subverted. And as the astrologer, you are not in possession of special knowledge. You are merely you merely have access to a tool, and the purpose of the tool is to facilitate communication and to bring things to the light. And part of how you protect yourself and your clients is you make sure that you stay in process. You make sure that you, first of all, have a very solid foundation in training in therapy, which you will do first by being a client. You've got to find somebody solid and honest. I mean, this is important, to find the right therapist, because I've heard, in my travels and work with my clients, I've heard a lot of negative stories about therapists. Most of mine are good, but I've had my run-ins with practitioners who just don't know what they're doing, or, don't have guts, or can be dishonest or have another agenda. And so you need to find someone good and model yourself after what they're doing, because there's something that's just I'm mortified that this is not taught at astrology conferences, but I don't think I've ever seen, unless I taught it, a class on counseling room procedure. Like, what do you do when the client sits down in your consulting area, assuming you're a professional, and even if you're, not, you can sit at the kitchen table, what do you do with the person? How do you conduct yourself? All of the classes, 99% of them, are generally astrological theory. There's, for example, I would advise any astrology conference to have classes by non-astrologer therapists teaching astrologers how to handle themselves in a counseling situation, which is what you're in. You're not a licensed counselor by all chances. You're not a licensed therapist. Maybe you sent away your thing and became a minister, went to a class, but how do you work with a person? And the way you learn that is by having it modeled for you. You need a strong example, preferably a few strong examples, and some experience in group process. And you just give yourself this as part of your personal healing process and part of your training, because you're going to be in situations where your assistance is needed. Not to evangelize for A Course in Miracles too much. It's a difficult process, and you have to deal with the fact the whole thing is written in male-gendered, Catholic-sounding language. But if you can get past that, and we do live in a culture where the religions are all basically male language, and so it speaks to that audience. I think that's who it was written for. I think A Course in Miracles was basically written for people who were fucked up by Christianity, but who can at least use the language as a starting place. All the terms are redefined or clarified. Again, the main thing you learn from A Course in Miracles is just how to tune in to your inner teacher and how to ask for help. I also strongly suggest that astrologers have widely diverse knowledge, that you go deep into things and not be a dilettante, but that you invest yourself in things and you know enough. I mean, I came to astrology after a lengthy career as a journalist from about age 17 or 16 to about age 30, 31, and I continued as an investigative reporter for about the first 5 years of my astrology practice. And so when I came to astrology, I could work with people in any line of work because I was trained as a journalist to talk to people in any line of work about any subject at all. And so whatever your background is, it helps to be conversant and to know enough to ask people an intelligent question, because you're going to be doing a lot of that as a practitioner who's not doing the woo-woo type of astrology and telling them their destiny and whatever. And so to engage people in what they're doing on their terms, that's an important skill to have. And it again serves the purpose of keeping the discussion and the narrative on the client's terms. It's very helpful to people to be able to converse with someone and keep things on their terms. And for you to be able to do that, you need diverse language. I mean, one of my concepts of national service is that everyone upon graduating from college should be required to be a small town journalist for 2 years. So they're not afraid to call up the mayor at 6 o'clock in the morning and ask them why they're doing that thing, or call anyone and ask them any question. And one of the ways I learned astrology was I had a source named David Rell, the owner of the Astrology Center of America, who's since passed away a few years ago, who would give me any phone number and email address that I wanted. This is like before the World Wide Web was so prolific, and I would just call people up. As long as I didn't tell you who gave me the number, I was good at kind of brushing that off, and I would just call anyone and ask them anything, and I found that people were happy to talk to me for whatever reason that was. So, hence I've had 15 really good long conversations with Rob Hand and many other people. And I encourage you to do this. I know people seem to be busy, but, reach out and learn how to be conversant with far superior astrologers, the best ones, and with people on any subject. And this all is about being more effective and protecting you. And protecting your client. So, under diverse knowledge, read deeply, study things, you understand what's going on in society, learn how to stand back from final judgment, learn how to keep your mind open. It is an uncomfortable position for many people to be in, to not jump to a conclusion. And it makes others a little itchy and scratchy if there's someone else not jumping to a conclusion. But for your clients, they will find it to be a helpful and productive space to know that they're not just being judged. And if in particular you know how to not be judgmental about sex and relationships, you're going to find yourself with a lot of people coming to you for help. But you need to be well-read and well-conversant and to have worked through some of whatever damage was done to you by whatever, entity inflicted the damage, whether it was a school teacher or church or just the usual, flogging from parents and the kind of diminishing of children's curiosity, to have worked out some of that so that you personally can remain open as other people go through their deepest personal exploration process. Moving right along here, we're almost done with this bit. One of the things I recommend for all astrologers is to give yourself a survey class to make sure that you have at least dipped in to most of the major phases in astrological history. So there's plenty of resources at Planet Waves, for example, to give you a solid, at least introduction to ancient and classical astrology. There's interviews with Rob Hand and Rob Schmidt right on the front page of Planet Waves FM, and you can listen to those four or five times. You'll get something valuable even the fifth time you play it through, so you've got an introduction to that. And then identify different, you know, I'll do a piece eventually that explains, you know, that breaks out the kind of chronology. But you should be familiar with what Alice Bailey had to say and with some of the stuff in the late 20th century before Alice Bailey was talking about this. And then some of the better pop astrology writers of the 1970s. And there's a number of phases of astrology that you want to tap into, the humanistic phase and the pop phase, and then like there's the Evangeline Adams phase in the early 20th century, where basically our jobs were all invented, or at least my job was invented. The kind of public astrologer who writes columns and answers questions from the public, and then also does clients, and to have a sense of the history, so that you can see where, for example, Chiron enters the picture and what's going on, and then what happens in now the ensuing almost 50 years. One of the interesting things historically about Chiron is that in the case of new planetary discoveries, there are almost always pre-discovery photos. They're now nicknamed pre-discovery photos. I still use the word pre-discovery for clarity. And it turns out that the first recorded image of Chiron was almost 100 years before its proper discovery, which it was in 1895. So these astronomers are very organized about how they catalog their photos of the sky. These things are all discovered using photography. I mean, I guess backyard astronomers can, like, they're looking around and they see a comet, but professional astronomers, for the most part, are taking pictures because they're looking at things that are very distant and very small, and they're using a thing called a blink microscope, which shows the movement of a thing, over the course of an hour. Right? Almost everything is discovered this way. You point the telescope at part of the sky, and you take pictures every hour or so, and then what moves is possibly your thing. So the first pre-discovery photo of Chiron was in 1895, and that happens to be the year that D.D. Palmer kind of rediscovers chiropractic. He basically makes an adjustment to someone's back and resolves deafness in a patient. I don't know the patient's name, but it was a janitor in the building he was working in. And he examined the guy's back and figured out that there was vertebrae out of place. And he just put the vertebrae back in place, and the guy could hear again. And I'm the only person I know who jumps up and down in the front of the lecture room when I tell this story. But he called the art chiropractic in 1895, and that's the year of the first pre-discovery photo of Chiron. And this holistic concept of healing with the hands starts to emerge again, I think, at that time. The word Chiron means one who has hands. And that's because Chiron was a horse and a man, and he had two hands. He had hoofs for feet, but he had hands that we would use for, you know, all things you use hands for. So that's what the word means. But it predates ancient Greek, according to Dieter Koch. And so it seems to come out of some prior language. This may have a very old lineage, and that's kind of a thing with the centaurs, is they always seem to snake back through the ancestral labyrinth, and so anytime you see a centaur in action, you know to be sensitive to the possibility that you're about to be snaked back through down the foggy ruins of time, and be ready, be paying attention, and don't get too swept away. All right, talked about the emergence of Chiron in the late 70s and early 80s by people like Stein and Morrison. One interesting bit is that You know, there was no ephemeris for Chiron at the time that it was discovered. And so Zane Stein reaches out to Brian Marsden, who was the director of the Minor Planet Center at Harvard, which catalogs all these points. And he did the calculation from, I think, a right ascension ephemeris to a longitude ephemeris so that astrologers could actually use it and plot it in charts. And this begins a tradition of astrologers being friends with astronomers. Now, it's not that big of a tradition, but I thought it was a good idea, and I always reach out to astronomers and have gotten a lot of interesting interviews with astronomers over the years. And the thing about working with the centaurs is, and these newer discoveries out in the Kuiper Belt, like Eris and Pluto, is that you want to be versed in astronomy. And so this is, I recommend having some mastery of one science. Astronomy is a very good science because it dovetails right into astrology. And astronomy is largely the science of categorization of orbiting objects and stars. And it's a very rich time in astronomy. And there's been a lot of work done. I mean, I've probably written 20 articles that touch on the astronomy of these points in minor or major ways. And there's plenty of material out there. And it helps to understand these concepts, you know, what the different types of objects are, why something, for example, gets categorized as a centaur. And one of the reasons it gets categorized as a centaur is because it crosses an orbit of another point. And it happens that there were two of those known before Chiron. One was Hidalgo, discovered in 1920, and Pluto, discovered in 1930, both of which are orbit crossers. Hidalgo crosses the orbit of Jupiter, and Pluto crosses the orbit of Neptune. And Chiron crosses the orbit of Saturn, and I'm a little iffy on Uranus. I think that it crosses the mean orbit, the average orbit of Uranus. In one of the orbital diagrams I saw today. Previously, I was taught that it goes almost out to the edge of Uranus's orbit, but I mean, it's going to spend 9 years in Aries, and Uranus only spends 7 years in a time. So we can say that at least honorary Chiron crosses the orbits of Saturn, becomes an inner planet, and of Uranus, and becomes way outer planet. Once it's outside of Saturn's orbit, it's considered an outer planet and will behave more like one in terms of how fast it goes. And this is true of a lot of things, but Chiron called attention to that initially. So Pluto, for example, spends 12 years in Scorpio and 20 years in Taurus. I mean, that's really interesting. It means that our grandparents had a very different experience of Pluto than we're having, just for example. So, keep up with this and read as much as you can. Find all the Planet Waves articles. Maybe we'll make an archive or resource of them. There's tons and tons of resource pages. We love making these things up. And there's a lot of writing in my kind of personal portfolio that touches on the discoveries and the discoverers and the science behind things. And it's just a great pleasure to learn this. Just focusing, and against our two for thoughts or questions, on the orbit of Chiron for a second. Let's see if I can find this thing. It didn't really transmit in the first, the shortened URL didn't work. Got an orbital diagram. All right. Can you find that link that begins with true node ephemeris 1? Let me just resend that out. It's a very cool tool to use. The subject header is going to say ephemeris tool. And a guy named John Donne, not the metaphysical conceit poet, but an astrologer and programmer, programmed this thing. And you can basically make a custom ephemeris for any orbiting bodies orbiting our sun It can be a minute-to-minute ephemeris. It can be an hourly ephemeris, a daily ephemeris, weekly, monthly, yearly, 10-year ephemeris, whatever you want. And what I've made here is just for one body, Chiron, 1977 UB, that was its name, and original name, and I've set it as about a 51-year ephemeris. So you'll see the thing will come. You click on it and just scroll down a little bit. And notice you can add any points you want up top. I've just used Chiron. And if you look at the thing, you'll see that Chiron seems to spend 6 years in Taurus, probably a little less, and then five in Gemini, and then three in Cancer, and then two in Leo, and then less than two in Virgo, and less than two in Libra, and less than two in Scorpio. And then that's because it's near the Earth, near the Sun. It's called perihelion. And so it comes close in and it moves through the zodiac more quickly. And then as it moves away from the Sun, it moves through the zodiac more slowly. So you can see with Sagittarius, that's 3 years, and then Capricorn is 4 years, then Aquarius is 5 years, and then Pisces is about 8 years, and then Aries is 9 years, and then we're back in Taurus. And so this creates a really interesting condition, because depending on how old you are, you may have had a heck of a lot of Chiron transits, for your age, whereas, you know, your parents may not have, but people who are born, let's say, for example, in like 1989 have had a great many Chiron transits. It starts in Cancer and then it comes back to Aries. I've had like a great many Chiron transits, say, for example, in the first 15, 20 years of life, where if you're born in the 1960s, you've only had your Chiron square, by age 20. Now, there's other planets involved. We'll get to those when we look at Cheryl's chart. But the point is that at certain times in history, certain times during each century, Chiron is whipping through the zodiac, and then it slows down. And so you'll see that there's concentrations of Chiron transits that can happen in certain ages of life, and those are very rapid transitional times for people, and things can be coming at them very quickly. But then when it's operating as an outer planet and moving slowly, there can also be these kind of Pluto-like major transitions at those times. So after a while, you get a feel for it, and you start to get a sense of just a gentle loose sense of the pattern of things. All right, so let's see. We've been talking for an hour, covered quite a bit of territory for 1 hour. This is a workshop that I've even done in 4 days. So this discussion would be the Friday night. Kind of lecture portion. And then Saturday morning piece is learning how to spot a transit. So I know not everyone listening feels too confident doing that, but there's a bunch of people listening who feel very confident spotting a transit. And all a transit is when a moving planet is making an aspect to a stationary planet. So if you have Saturn in the first degree of Taurus, now Uranus is in early Taurus, you've got Uranus conjunct Saturn. And it's easy to spot these. And when we are working with Chiron transits, we're just going to look at the position of Chiron and imagine it in the chart around the outer wheel and just notice what it's doing in against or to or with the natal chart. So we'll get there in a second. There's a special ephemeris we're using from the website serenu.com, S-E-R-E-N-N-U. I think Tracy accepts at minimum $1 a month and up to a whopping $10 a month. I would highly recommend getting on there. You get many, many more very useful features. And, you know, she programmed this thing, you know, living on nuts and berries, and it's one of the most useful, powerful astrology tools that that there is, and has been a labor of love over the past 15 years. Okay, so let's conclude this part with Chiron concepts, and I'm going to take a little break and catch my breath. Over the years, and often coming from the early part of the work, in the late 70s and early 80s, some key concepts emerged for Chiron, and they're all helpful in some way. So the first one was given to it by its discoverer, Charles Kowal. So one of the odd things about Chiron is that its first astrological keyword comes from the astronomer who discovered it, and that's the word maverick. Maverick is somebody who stands out. Old Mr. Maverick was the guy who wouldn't brand his cattle. He thought it was cruel, and he wouldn't brand his cattle. Imagine that, like jamming a hot thing and burning their flesh, and he just thought this was ridiculous. And so the word maverick came out as an idea of breaking from the norm. And so one of the things Chiron does is, you know, where it's working in the chart, and whether that's by natal or transit, Chiron will tend to break from the norm. And this has a number of different manifestations of standing out, of distinction, of letting yourself be who you are, people who can't help but be different in ways that they struggle with. There's a number of different expressions of maverick and distinction, but where there's Chiron, look for distinction in some way. Another one that's not discussed often enough is mentorship. Mentorship is basically one-on-one teaching, and that's one of the functions that therapy serves, is a one-on-one teaching function. And it is usually between an older and a younger person, but, you know, in the case of my own musical mentors, I've got very strong Chiron, very strong mentorship going on. Much younger men have taught me music, and so it's not necessarily the older teaching the young. You have to be sensitive to when, you know, the young people are the qualified, competent, grounded teachers. And this is not exactly, mentorship is not like teaching by being a nut job. Mentorship is teaching by being a stable, steady, example. There's other kinds of teaching that comes when the less stable people show up, but that's not really mentorship. Mentorship is when you are taught or you accept someone who comes to you for guidance, and it might be for 1 hour, and it might be for 30 or 40 years. And by the way, it's not the kind of thing you can like hang up a shingle and say, "Hi, I'm a mentor." These relationships appear somewhat mysteriously, and when you find one, it's best to treat the relationship really well, because you will learn things in that relationship that you can't learn anywhere else. And one of the most helpful things in mentorship relationships is the modeling of example. Make sure you have this in anyone you choose as a therapist or as a practitioner. The hidden cycle. Most planets work with a fairly regimented cycle. You can trace the cycle of Venus, the cycle of Uranus, the cycle of Saturn. These things have very predictable cycles. Chiron works in this odd way where it takes 18 months to go through Libra and then 9 years to go through Aries. That's kind of weird. And so underneath that are all kinds of hidden cycles. When we do one example, which I'm doing to show you how to do this, and after you've done 10 or 20 of these, what you'll see is that you're learning to identify points of transition in people's lives that they would have never associated with one another. people tend to be somewhat dissociative about their own histories. They don't necessarily have a very strong thread of the continuity of their growth process. Most people just kind of plunge headlong into life. They're not really necessarily looking back pretty much except for regret and nostalgia. And so when you work with people with Chiron, you're going to uncover hidden cycles. And one of the themes of those hidden cycles is likely to be some form of making whole or of holistic consciousness. And whether that's true or not, that's one of the things you're doing with Chiron. So any idea that associates whole system thinking, the concept of synergy, the concept of biophilia, very good book. I forget the author's name, but it's about the it's a short book and philosophical. He doesn't understand dogs, which kind of makes me wonder. But overall, besides that, it's a really good book. I mean, and dogs are one of the best examples of biophilia, right? Dogs are one of the most important symbiosis in the entire utterly unique symbiosis, because of the way that dogs not only provide companionship, but they're helping us hunt and herd cattle and protect the flock and protect the household. It's a completely unique symbiosis in nature, and the concept of biophilia is about symbiosis. So that's a concept of a Chiron out of the holistic kind of school of thought. And so you can make a little research project, and we could even define a research project at Planet Waves of holistic philosophies. And imagine a holistic philosophies resources area where we find the best books on holistic philosophy. We quote a few paragraphs of the book and we put a link to where to find the book and maybe an interview with the author. The concept of holistic is kind of getting lost right now. It's getting lost in all this digital bullshit where everyone is training to be a robot instead of training to be a whole person. We're at a real disadvantage when you can just tap your phone and sushi arrives at your door. That's not very exciting. Healing, meaning facilitation of healing, and also, with Chiron, you're going to come up with a number of events where people have to seek medical advice and surgery. There's a whole kind of way to handle that. We should make a note of that, how to handle medical issues. We talk about it among the astrologers at Planet Waves when, we have to work with clients that call in. But you want to be sensitive to your role in collaborating with other healers, because often people will come to you and they'll be working with several other people. What role do you have in that? What I have found is that that there's a way to do astrology that can be very facilitating of therapy by helping people notice what to focus on in therapy, and then they do that work with their therapist. And the concept comes out of their chart, but the process is done with the therapist. Chiron brings about rapid transition, so we'll see those happen. And the transitions tend to follow the houses and the planets in the chart. So if somebody's got Jupiter in the ninth house and Chiron makes a conjunction to that Jupiter, you can be pretty sure they're going to have some kind of a spiritual awakening. And if Chiron goes over their ascendant, you can be pretty sure they may redefine their whole life in some way. And without telling them what that is, you want to find out what it was and use them, use their resources to help them. Chiron is often feels like shining a bright light in dark places, underwater or something. You want to make sure that you're doing this thing the Course in Miracles recommends, which is not bringing light into the darkness, but bringing the darkness to the light. It may seem like, what's the difference? But if you meditate on that for like a couple of years, not bringing the light into the darkness, but rather bringing the darkness to the light. And so Chiron brings a light of awareness, and awareness is basically the main tool that we need to make conscious choices. So that's our little introduction to to Chiron. And, you know, please deepen and develop this. It doesn't really matter where you start. Any one of these ideas will be, you know, will be helpful. In terms of the best books, I would say that for the early books, Zane Stein, Essence and Application, A View from Chiron, is the best one. Barbara Hand Clough's book is very popular and has some things that no other book has, but a lot of her stuff comes straight from Zane Stein. Zane Stein will not be as polite as I am being in saying this, but it's brilliant and deeply revealing. And my favorite work by Melanie Reinhardt is Saturn, Chiron, and the Centaurs: To the Edge and Beyond. And what I love about that is she begins with Saturn. And to understand Chiron, you have to understand and I think to some extent really have a love affair with Saturn. This is not easy for people. And there's astrology, probably not today because it's Easter, tomorrow there'll be astrology classes being taught that are teaching people to be afraid of Saturn and not to value this, but Saturn is our grounding. It's our respect for the passage of time. It's our respect for basic categorization and boundaries and for establishing a relationship with authority and skin and bones. I mean, Saturn rules the skin and bones. I mean, would you want to, you know, be an amoeba? The only thing standing between you and being an amoeba is that you've got Saturn. You've got it in your mind, and you've got it in your bones and your skin, and you work with this factor. Uranus is the other end of the kind of the spectrum of Chiron, and that's a little easier to understand, but not so much. I mean, most people, I think, experience Uranus as being disruptive and don't really know how to harness its energy. People like Thomas Edison and the Wright brothers and them knew how to harness the energy of Uranus because you have to work for the breakthrough and be present. Ben Franklin, he was good at working with Uranus. You know, he's out there flying his kite right around when Chiron Uranus is discovered, first planet discovered by science. Being friends with Saturn first and Uranus second and understanding what these transits are about will fill in your knowledge of Chiron. And as you study the transits of Chiron to Saturn and to Uranus and the transits of Saturn to Chiron and Uranus to Chiron will all start to fill in. And notice I'm not saying stuff your head full of astrology books here. I think that If you've had a look at my little monograph I wrote late last year, where I did a thing on Venus square Mars, and I looked up, you know, I've got quite an impressive astrology library, which anyone's welcome to come and sit in my office and avail yourself of if you want to make it all the way to fantastic Kingston, New York. I looked up Venus square Mars in every astrology book that I had that had such things, and it was like a Stephen King novel. I mean, it was like going through The Shining of astrology, and it started to make me really suspicious of the shit that's in books. And even though you have to have them and you have to read them, you've got to be careful. And I think that, you know, we can have even a book discussion list and like who's got the best take on Saturn. Well, I think Melanie has the best take on Saturn. You don't need a like 1,000-page Liz Green book to understand Saturn. You just don't. But Melanie gives a very succinct exposition of Saturn and in Saturn, Chiron, and the Centaurs, To the Edge and Beyond. So a few books on Chiron will be helpful. And mostly what you just do is you practice. You cast a chart for everything. You start working with your own chart and looking at your own transits and journaling them out. And then you move on to people who you already have established trust with and some knowledge of, and you go through the Chiron transit process with them. And after about 10 or 15 of these, you'll start to feel like you have your sea legs, and then you can start experimenting with a wider public. You can sit in a cafe. There's a lot of things you can do. I think that you know, sitting in a cafe and reading tarot cards is a very productive thing for aspiring astrologers to do. All right, let's leave it there for a few minutes. I'm gonna take a pause. I need to stop long enough to eat something so that I can be focused for the for Cheryl's portion. While I'm taking a break, it'll be about 10 or 12 minutes. I suggest you take a look at the charts that I've put up on the resources page. They include, because now I'm in full on moon landing mode, we have the progress chart. The reason I put that up is the progress chart of Neil Armstrong on the day of the supposed moon landing. Take a look at that chart. And in all of the discussions of the moon landing, I'm sure no astronomer would be happy about this. The best evidence that it actually happened is coming from astrology. So they can all go fuck themselves. And then Betty Dodson is another one of my favorite Chiron charts. Maybe you're not sure who Betty Dodson is. So you type Betty Dodson, Eric Francis into the internet machine, you'll come up with like 10 articles. And this is in my long tradition of teaching Betty Dodson's chart in every class I ever teach. I've probably missed a few, but we're not going to miss today. Take a look at Betty Dodson's Chiron in Taurus. They're both born around the same time, 1929, 1930, respectively. Chiron in Taurus, they both have that. And Betty has Chiron on the North Node in Taurus in the ninth house. And tell me that's just not the perfect Chiron placement for a, you know, figure so unique as Betty Dodson. All right, don't be bashful about asking questions. And let me see if I can find the control panel for this class. Here it is. So thank you for your attention. I'm going to mute myself. And it's now 4:15, and I'll be back a little bit before 4:30. So get yourself something to eat, drink, bathroom break, and then we'll take a quick look at those two charts, and then we'll work with Cheryl for an hour, and then they'll leave us time for some questions at the end.